This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Do you remember the power pose craze from about a decade ago? In the second most popular TED Talk ever, psychologist Amy Cuddy told over 60 million viewers that they can change their lives by simply changing their body language. If you grew up in the 1990s, you probably experienced classes devoted to boosting your self-esteem independent of your actual achievements on tests or assignments. Have you ever taken the Implicit Association Test, or IAT, which claims to test your unconscious bias against minorities or other groups? It's routinely used in all sorts of diversity training programs and educational settings, from K-12 classes through college. These are all examples of what science writer and podcaster Jesse Singel calls quick fixes that attempt to address pressing social issues based on fundamentally flawed psychological research. In his new book, The Quick Fix: Why Fad Psychology Can't Cure Our Social Ills, Singel looks at these and other attempts to change policy based on bad or faulty science. One of Cuddy's fellow researchers has said that their research doesn't prove anything. The K-12 curriculum that started the self-esteem boom was based on a misreading of Nathaniel Brandon's work by a single powerful California politician. And the IAT is not only unreliable, the same individual will generate very different scores when they retake the test, it's not clear that unconscious bias is a major influence on how we act toward one another. Singel is the co-host of the popular podcast Blocked and Reported. He tells me his goal is to explain why we keep falling for ideas that psychologists say will fix society, so we waste less time focusing on things that don't really help anyone, and maybe focus more attention on things that just might. Here is The Reason Interview with Jesse Singel. Jesse Singel, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
You know what? Let's get right to it. Give me the elevator pitch of your book.
Should we talk about my surroundings first? Because you found them a little bit alarming when you first saw me.
They are, you know, and for the podcast people, yeah, we need to paint a picture with words. But you are in kind of a wood-paneled basement that looks like the new set that Tucker Carlson has unmasked. Yeah. It's kind of like a sweat lodge or perhaps an American Apparel backdrop. I don't know if you're auditioning you know, knitwear underwear or something like that, but it's kind of got a Fiona Apple criminal vibe to it. Why are you in a wood-paneled basement?
Thank you so much for asking. I'm visiting my parents, and my normal recording setup won't really work for video. So I'm in my youngest brother's closet. He got the biggest closet of the three of us. I assume that's because he was the most beloved. I'm working through some stuff as we have this conversation.
That is kind of disturbing. But, also kind of wonderful. Enough distraction. What is the capsule summary, the elevator pitch of the quick fix?
Yeah, the goal of this book is to explain to people why we keep falling for the ideas that psychologists sell us about the ways they're going to help fix society. And these ideas have had a really good time in the 21st century. They've gone viral. TED Talk culture is doing quite well. Over and over and over, I've noticed that these ideas will burst onto the scene. They'll offer some incredible new way to fight racism or to improve education or to improve gender equity in the workplace. There's a rush of attention, often a rush of research dollars. Everyone gets really into them. There's the NPR and New York Times coverage. And then a few years later, more research comes out. We realize the idea was barely true, if that, and it ends up having wasted a lot of time. So that's sort of the phenomenon my book is about.
Okay. And, you know, one of the things we'll get into with several, we're going to go into particular examples of things. When, you know, when the tide comes out on these things, it's like there's a lot of debris left on the shore, a lot of kind of institutional structures that often stay in place long after an idea has been completely discredited and or discarded. So that's a kind of, you know, this is not simply making fun of, you know, a fad that then, you know, it's, we're not talking about, I guess John Lennon and Yoko Ono went through primal scream therapy back in the early 70s, which doesn't have a lot of adherence, and other than some ruptured vocal cords, you know, didn't really leave much, as opposed to, we'll talk about this, kind of self-esteem movement, which was born out, and particularly out of one California politician's kind of zany ideas, and it still casts kind of a long shadow on playgrounds all over America. So before we go into some of the examples, you talk, one of the controlling ideas for you is a thing that you call prime world. Can you briefly describe what that is?
Yeah, social psychologists are really into this idea of a prime, and a prime is sort of a subtle cue that unconsciously affects your behavior in a surprisingly powerful way. So there was this rush of experiments, mostly in the 21st century, where it's like, if I blast you with cold air, you will be less socially welcoming to others. The idea that it somehow primes a sense of social coolness. So biases, we know what biases are, you know, just sort of systemic errors in the way we view the world. They can be racial biases. They can be just numerical biases. According to the tenets of prime world, we can fix pretty complicated problems just by tweaking individuals, by making them less susceptible to primes and biases. And in my view, this is sort of a unrealistic view of the world, because human behavior is so overdetermined, and we often, you know, we don't need to spark a whole free will debate here, but I think we would both agree that our social networks and our culture and our religion and our social class, they all really restrict how much we can change our behavior, or they have some ability to do that. It isn't like we're just sort of a sheet of paper being gusted around by primes and biases. Human behavior is a lot more complicated than that.
Having said that, I think we'll get into whatever is the closest you can get into in a fist fight over Zoom, because I suspect that I believe more in autonomy than you do, although now, just to contradict myself immediately, maybe less so. But yeah, you know, and you know, the concept of overdetermination, the idea that there are multiple reasons why things turn out the way they do, that seems to be one of the core themes in your book and in a lot of your work. And I think it more generally in the best science journalism is that instead of trying to isolate the one true thing that explains everything, the best science journalists, and I think you're, you know, certainly in that category, it's no, this is much more complicated than we ever want it to be.
Yeah. And let me give you one concrete example from a book that I critique. There's a guy named John Barge. He's a Yale social psychologist, one of the—
Oh, I hate him already.
One of those Yaleys. He wrote a book called Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. And at one point he says, when the weather's hot, people believe in global warming. When the weather's cold, they don't. There's like a tiny experimental effect where people seem to have some error where they'll, when you ask them how much they believe in global warming, they'll sort of think back to sort of the recent weather, which isn't really relevant to that question. Overall, what he's saying is just like false. We believe in global warming or don't, mostly because of our partisan affiliations and our social networks and our families. That's an example of where I would agree with you. People have some autonomy over what they believe, but it isn't the fact that, oh, it was cold yesterday, so I don't believe in global warming. It's more, I'm a Republican, or my fellow churchgoers don't believe it. Like, that's what generates human outcomes, is all that messy, multi-determined stuff, not, oh, it's cold out, so global warming must be fake.
All right, so let's go to some examples, and I'm going to start with some of the more what I consider the more trivial ones in the book, and then we're going to get to the bigger ones that have to do with things like nudging, you know, on a kind of societal level basis, but also implicit bias, you know, in tests that are easily administered that purport to show just how racist we all are in inescapable ways, et cetera. But let's start with a kind of silly one. This is the power pose. Explain what the power pose is, and how did the power pose, you know, wrap its, you know, legs and arms akimbo fashion around our necks?
Yeah. You know, I realize I can never remember the precise dates, which I should by now. I think it was 2010, three researchers, one of whom is Amy Cuddy of Harvard Business School, a psychologist there, they released a study showing that when they had kids adopt expansive poses with their sort of arms on their hips like Wonder Woman or arms out versus contractive poses, which is more like a mummy pose, like you're sort of slunk in on yourself, The people in the experiment had higher levels of testosterone and were more likely to make sort of take this bet, a double or nothing bet in a dice rolling game over, I think, $2. So not exactly high stakes. But Amy Cuddy in particular spun this into a TED Talk and a book called Presence. And she argued that power posing for a minute or two before a meeting, for example, could make you feel more powerful and could sort of help address gender gaps in the workplace. And this really sort of melded with Lean In Feminism, because Lean In came, Sheryl Sandberg's book came out at the same time.
But it's Lean In, but keep your arms spread wide.
Lean, just or sort of rub you, up against
on your
someone.
Hams, yeah, on your exactly. hips. You know, it's kind of like, I mean, it's actually, it's a form of, you know, kind of expert Simon Says, right?
Exactly. It's sort of like a curtsy type thing.
So what did you find, though, when you, you know, because this is the method of your book is as important as any of the examples that you kind of work through. What did you find when you looked at their own relevant research?
There's not a huge amount there. I mean, so what was interesting about writing this book is some of the chapters were about ideas that by the time I got to them, they had been pretty well debunked already. And power posing by that point had failed in replication attempts, you know, meaning people had tried to run the study back and just not found anything. It had received some mainstream attention. But it was basically like an example of why you can't take one experiment from a lab setting and then extrapolate from it and make sort of strong statements about human life and human behavior as a result. And in Amy Cuddy's blockbuster TED Talk, she basically said that the difference between power posing can sort of reconfigure your brain to make you more assertive and to make you more effective. There was never really evidence for that. There was evidence for a small effect on testosterone and on cortisol, the stress hormone. The power posers had less cortisol. And, you know, behavior in this little dice game. There's unfortunately an incentive within psychology to exaggerate, because if you exaggerate, you get the books and the TED Talks and one of the only ways to make a lot of money as a psychologist is stuff like that.
So maybe for Dungeons and Dragons people, did in the dice game, did it work for, you know, kind of like dodecahedron or, you know, 10-sided die, do you think? Would that be more or less powerful?
They saved their critical rolls. I never really played much D&D. I think it was literally just they would give the participants $2. And have them roll, if they say, if you want, you can play a double or nothing game where you have a 50% chance to double that by rolling a die, which isn't even like, I don't know what that means to accept that versus not accept it, because the expected value to be a nerd is $2 in either case. It didn't really show anything. So it's just weird that they interpreted that way. And I should say, one of Cuddy's two co-authors, a woman named Dana Carney, who's at UC Berkeley, she posted a thing to her faculty website saying, I think we made some methodological errors in this study. I think the effect is totally false. So even one of the people who discovered power posing has come out and said, there's nothing there.
Yeah. Let's talk about the self-esteem movement. The first chapter of the book is called The Selling of Self-Esteem. And this is fascinating. And I have to say, going into it, I went to school in the 70s and the 80s, and on the East Coast and in a Catholic school. So, you know, self-esteem was like not something anybody talked about. To the extent we talked about it was how do you find it and destroy it. But having said that, I kind of get bothered when people shit on self-esteem and say, oh, you know, like everybody has self-esteem or they're, you know, everybody gets participation trophies. Like every trophy I've ever had is a participation trophy. I mean, the fucking Olympics are participation trophies on some level. And the idea that self-esteem is automatically bad strikes me as like monstrous, really, especially when we're talking about little kids who might need it. But tell me the self-esteem movement, and you experienced this somewhat in your childhood or in your own schooling, but what is the self-esteem movement? What are the psychological props it's on, and why is it all kind of horseshit?
Yeah, a California state assemblyman named John Vasconcelos sort of discovered self-esteem through the work of Nathaniel Brandon, who is a disciple and lover of Ayn Rand, who was a big fan of self-esteem. He convinced himself and a bunch of other people that self-esteem or a lack of it lay at the root of all sorts of social problems, including crime. And he got the governor of California to sort of set up a commission for him to study the idea further. they very badly misinterpreted the evidence for the public, as a journalist named Will Storr, who's also great, discovered in his book. So you had this thing that a lot of people weren't taking seriously at first that really caught on around the country. And the problem is not, you know, trying to make sure kids have good self-esteem. The problem is the claim that improving self-esteem can fix all these negative societal outcomes, which there was never really any evidence for. And the other funny thing is, like, people would talk about an epidemic of low self-esteem among Americans. America has a lot of problems. That is not one of them.
Yeah.
We have many shortages, including now,
we
like
are the country of the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? We think much more highly of our capabilities than any vaguely objective measure would come across with.
So yeah, it's funny in retrospect that anyone thought we had a deficit of self-esteem.
But the idea was, and the way that I understand it from your kind of sense is that it wasn't, and this is even somebody like Nathaniel Brandon, his idea was that as you develop self-esteem by accomplishing things or building on things, self-esteem is the product of something, not the cause of it. And then the way it kind of got inserted into California educational curricula and elsewhere then was the idea you confer self-esteem, high self-esteem on somebody, and that will make them a better worker. It'll make them a better student. It'll make them more productive. So it kind of has an ass backwards, even as a theoretical concept.
Yeah, I think I ended up cutting this, but I initially had a paragraph or two about how Vasconcelos either misinterpreted the idea or sort of mutated it. Because, yeah, Brandon's whole thing was like, you know, this is someone who's in objectivist circles. It's the individual accomplishing great things and looking upon their works and feeling proud of it. Whereas Vasconcelos, you know, he gave rise to kids singing and chanting about how great they were. Not that you can expect a kindergartner to have accomplished anything, but it is posits a very flipped causal role for self-esteem.
What's the harm with something like that? Because, you know, I mean, you know, apart from it taking up, educational time during the day, but, you know, it's competing with a million other things, that waste people's time in school, waste kids' time in school. Is there a harm to, you know, kind of valorizing self-esteem or just handing it to people in an educational setting?
There's not a harm to, like, making people feel like they're loved or have worth. And, you know, at the extreme end of the bell curve, like, people with horribly low self-esteem do suffer as a result. That's why we have things like cognitive behavioral therapy. The harm is, like, partly opportunity cost, partly, I think with a lot of these ideas, people really, like, get a little bit fixated on them at the expense of other more important things. So if you really come to believe that criminals are committing crimes as a result of low self-esteem, that might distract you from the actual things that contribute to high crime rates.
Let's talk about grit. And I'm happy because I think I'm one of about 10 people left in America who remember the family newspaper, America's family newspaper, called Grit that you mentioned in passing. It was around for like 100 years. And in old comic books, they would constantly try and pitch kids to sell grit and win fabulous prizes. But grit as a concept is fascinating. And this is one that is very much with us. The idea that, you know, individuals who through, you know, pluck and determination, like, better themselves, they have true grit, or, you know, the ability to rise above and persevere and things like that. Tell me about who has grit and why you probably should just put it in the nearest recycling bin if you have too much grit.
Yeah, a social psychologist named Angela Duckworth, who would later win a MacArthur Genius Grant, not just for this, but
which, by the way, I think has replaced the Rhodes Scholar as a leading indicator that you're just full of shit in the 21st century. But please continue.
So she developed a scale to measure people's grit, which is supposed to capture both their ability to grit through difficult problems, but also their, like, passion for long-term goals. And she gave a TED talk and some interviews where the whole conceit here was that Americans are too into innate ability, you know, intelligence, physical strength. What we're missing from our accounts of who achieves and why is effort and stick-to-itiveness. I'm not sure I hit this hard enough in the chapter, but I don't even think that is credible. The idea that the U.S. as a country doesn't talk enough about, like, pulling yourself up by the bootstraps and effort and hard work. That aside, you develop. Yeah.
By the way, you know what's fascinating is that I think in almost every context other than academia, that is all people talk about. Like nobody, even Donald Trump wasn't like, I inherited a lot of money and right. look, I've kind of made it better. It's like, no, I'm a self-made man. Like the only place people don't constantly talk about grit or stick-to-itiveness is academia because nobody there wants to admit that they were ever poor and had bad taste. I that personally, but right. please continue.
So yeah, she developed a new scale to measure it. I took a grit test. I'm in the 10th percentile. So I'm maybe one of the least gritty journalists there is. And I think that was accurate.
There goes that 70 style reboot of Jesse Single without playing by Al Pacino. No, it's not happening.
Oh man, he'd do a great job. Yeah, wow. So she, you know, said she'd invented this new thing and that it did really well predicting achievement relative to these older measures like intelligence scores, SAT scores, physical ability. And, you know, it turns out she hadn't really discovered something new. We'd already had something called conscientiousness from the psych literature that they're almost identical to grit. It turns out they both do predict achievement. They both are not, in most settings, anywhere near as good as intelligence and things like that for predicting achievement. Only a year or two ago, we got our first study that took a representative sample of Americans and compared the importance of grit versus things like intelligence to determining these outcomes. And I think intelligence is, I believe, between 38 and 50 times more important than grit for determining workplace outcomes. For academic outcomes, it's 13%. I could be flipping those two. I can send you a link to the study to post it. But the point is, like, does grit matter a little in the grand scheme of things? Will a well-prepared, hardworking person do better than an identical person without those qualities? Sure. The question is whether she overhyped it, which I think she did, and whether, you know, in areas like education, it makes more sense to focus on grit than even basic things like making sure kids have access to tutoring or even good anti-truancy programs seem to improve performance. Whereas there's very little to latch onto with grit in terms of like, oh, here's an intervention that really works to close the achievement gap, say.
Yeah. And you, in that chapter, if I'm remembering correctly, you also talk about how, you know, one of her samples had to do with Marines or Army people going through a particularly tough kind of obstacle course or program to show, you know, if they were good enough to be in an elite force or something like that. And in fact, like it didn't predict very much there, but that's the type of place where this type of thought might be misapplied. Is that correct?
Yeah. So one of the problems with her studies is an issue called range restriction. So, you know, if I do a study of men's heights and I only focus on NBA players, that might not be generalizable to the broader public because they're already in the tallest part of the population. Similarly, she did a study with kids from West Point. These are already sort of the toughest, most talented, intelligent kids. Even there, she studied something called Beast Barracks, which is this brutal training exercise when you first start. It was the kind of thing where like 95% of the kids already complete it. And most people completed it. Grit, like a little bit, would help you. It was like high grit people completed at 97%, low grit at 93%. So there's just not much there. When you get out into the real world, into like the study I just mentioned, grit has way less predictive ability. And there, I explained in the chapter, there's these narrow technical senses in which it might, in some context, be a little bit important. But like a lot of the ideas in the book, it was just like way overhyped. And to me, just told us more about our own societal fixations and fascinations than about the strength of the evidence.
I guess, is it partly with something like grit, and we'll get into a more general discussion of why Prime World is such a attractive idea in a lot of ways, but something like grit, it's something we can control. You know, you're either born with superpowers or you're not, whereas like grit, you know, Batman can go into the gym and work out every day and kind of move up the scale closer to Superman. But if you're not from Krypton, and I actually want to stop talking about superheroes, but you know, if you're not from Krypton, you're just kind of screwed, right?
So hold on, I'm going to sneeze. Give me one second. Superman would not have sneezed, right? As the
yeah, that was a haunting, silent sneeze. It was like something from 12 Monkeys.
It was like an action movie. I hit the mic button right as well. So at the end of the chapter, what I point out is that like for all this talk of poor kids, and how grit might benefit them. There seems to be a pretty big market for like grit-related writing among people from backgrounds like mine, like sort of upper middle class people. And my theory, which I can't prove, is that, you know, if you grew up in an upper middle class setting and you're about my age, you know, a millennial, you're experiencing a fair amount of like downward mobility, or maybe at least stagnation. And you might have the sense that you're not going to do better than your parents. And that might cause you to search for sort of a side door that you had previously missed. So it's like, if I've spent all this time worrying about this other stuff, but really grit was the secret that could get me through that door. I think there's something to be said for that. And some other intelligent scholars of grit have pointed out that, like, for all the talk of poor kids, it's often sort of richer people who are most fascinated by grit.
So the stuff that we've been talking about so far, it all kind of emanates from social psychology, and we're going to talk about implicit bias in a minute. But I want to switch domains to economics, because in a lot of ways, you know, the economics profession, psychology, sociology, anthropology, have all had heydays where they were kind of a dominant way of explaining everything in American society. I think psychology is coming back in many ways. But economics has had this phenomenal run, really, for, you know, 20 or 30 years, where everybody's like, you got a problem, you go talk to an economist. You talk about the concept of nudging, which is associated with Richard Thaler, a recent Nobel Prize-winning economist who's also worked with Cass Sunstein, who's a legal scholar. What is nudging, and what did you find when you looked in to see if these, you know, if nudges in public policy can radically transform and improve outcomes for people?
Yeah. So the origin of nudging is basically like mid-20th century social science. For a long time, the assumption among social scientists is that humans are basically rational. There's this model called Homo economicus, which suggests that we're basically like robots, in that we have like clearly programmed preferences. We know how to maximize our profit or utility. The problem is just we're not great at actually doing numerical calculations. So that's what leads us to bad decisions. Two brilliant Israeli researchers, Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, came along and they said, well, no, we sort of have these baked in biases that you can actually like show experimentally, and those cause us to go astray when we make decisions and when we make certain calculations. And these are predictable types of irrationality. Predictably Irrational is one of the big books on this. And that in various ways evolved and infected some economists who had been very resistant to the idea in the late 20th century. And today we have nudging. And nudging is the idea that you can take what we know about human irrationality and you can use that to change people's environments to nudge them toward better decision making. Of course, that's a fraught concept, because who gets to decide what is better?
The smart guys from Chicago and Harvard, right?
Or podcaster author types. Yeah, exactly.
And the kind of paradigmatic nudge, I guess there's a couple of them. One is the idea that, you know, we have an organ shortage. So we should switch the default on driver's license from saying, do you want to be an organ donor if you get destroyed in a car wreck, to say you will be an organ donor. That's the default. And that nudge or that switch in a system will, you know, solve a problem of organ shortages. Another one that gets talked about a lot is the idea of automatically enrolling new employees in a 401k or in a retirement plan when it's an option, because once you put people in that, they rarely revisit their choice. So these are kind of ways of taking advantage or understanding how people don't act the way that they should according to whoever's lights, and kind of setting it up so they'll do better, right?
Yeah. And I graduated from a very psych-oriented public policy program in 2013, and they loved this stuff. A lot of the stuff was taught to us as though it were the gospel truth, including the organ donation thing. And a lot of it is based on sound ideas, like the power of defaults. People are pretty lazy and don't really think things through when they fill out most forms. So if you default to no instead of yes, they'll just be like, okay, whatever. And I think there's some solid evidence with the 401k.
I mean, it's a good idea, right? Or totally. It's not that it's a good idea. It's an eminently plausible idea.
Much more plausible than a lot of the ideas in my book. Yeah. You know, but then, you know, I looked into the research more, and I don't think the evidence that it actually works for organ donation is that great, or at least different countries have had very different experiences. And I think one reason for that is this is purely speculation, once the news gets out that the government is defaulting you into organ donations, you can see how people tend to have strongly held religious or spiritual feelings about their bodies that may be activated by that. It's not just like, it's a much more fraught decision than a 401k.
Right. And I mean, this is also the, you know, it's the type of thing where this type of logic was used even in antitrust cases where, you know, when Microsoft was bundling the Explorer web browser with its operating system, people were like, nobody will ever, you know, they'll just open the computer, a Microsoft computer, they'll start using Explorer, and no browser will ever be able to gain market share. And in fact, I know, and I'm on about my sixth or seventh computer since about 2000. And the first thing I do whenever I do, always PCs, the first thing I do is I go into Explorer or Edge now. Once I download Chrome or Firefox or all three, you know, a bunch of different browsers, and then never use the Microsoft product again. So when people, when it's important to people, you know, nudging has to be a shove, and then that raises a series of other kinds of questions, right?
Yeah, yeah. And but of course, the scientific question is whether a nudge works on the average person or produces an average level result. Because like my parents wouldn't care what web browser they use and wouldn't uninstall or install anything. It's nerds like us. But I basically, like, I come down pretty positively about nudges. I just point out that you need to A, test individual nudges to think they work. You can't just assume they'll work. And B, as with all these other ideas, you can't really expect them to do the work of actual, like, public policy, of actually fixing anything. And one of the examples I use is in New York City, they were issuing a lot of arrest warrants for failures to appear for things like public urination or drinking, the kinds of things that
that someone like you actually commit on a regular basis.
And I did get a ticket for public drinking. Well, I was going to say, good libertarians such as yourself do not believe the court system should be clogged with people who just pee all over the place.
I'm always willing to make exceptions when I know the person and I think that they're, you know, you are obviously guilty of something.
Exactly.
But, yeah. But so what did they do in order to, what was the nudge in the criminal justice system that you actually speak highly of? And I agree with your estimation there.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation where there was both a nudge and a shove. The nudge was they changed the layout of the citation form to make it clearer that you have to appear in court or you can have a bench warrant issued. People didn't realize that because, again, people aren't rational. They don't carefully read the thing and then pay. Of course, if you polled people and said you can pay $25 to not have a bench warrant, the vast majority of people would make that decision. But people are distracted, they're irrational, they're lazy, including myself in all three of those. So they changed the format of the summons form, and they started text messaging people to, like, make it clear, like, no, you have to pay this or you could end up in jail. That did work. It had a noticeable effect, I think, on the order of tens of thousands of cases a year. But the big thing they did is they changed the city's laws about public drinking, and they turned all of these from criminal summons to civil summons, meaning you can't have a bench warrant, you know, sent out just because of peeing or public drinking, which I think is much better policy, and that had a much bigger effect. So that's an example of how nudges can work and can improve things, but usually you need to, like, actually change the law if you want to improve a serious problem like people being thrown in jail for nothing.
Let's talk about implicit bias and the IAT, or implicit association test, because this is something, you know, everybody I know has taken the implicit, the IAT. Can you talk about what it is and what is the theory that it is, you know, kind of exemplifying, and where does it fall short?
So the IAT was introduced in 1998 as a short test you can take to reveal your level of so-called unconscious or implicit bias. And the basic idea is that by pairing black faces with bad words or white faces with good words, the strength of those associations in your head is reflected by how quickly you can make those connections in a computer exercise. And for a long time, the creators of this test said that your score on an IAT predicts your real-world behavior, and it could reveal you to be biased against black people, even though you don't think you are at all. Those claims have, like, really fallen apart. In 2015, Mazarin Banaji and Anthony Greenwald, who created the test, said in an academic paper, this test is too noisy to individually diagnose people. And it's striking that in 2021, I don't think most people know that. I think this test is routinely still a part of diversity trainings. And I think it presents a version of the world in which, like, racially discrepant outcomes are caused by implicit bias. And the argument I make in my book is that I think implicit bias is real just by virtue of how our brains work. They're irrational. They form patterns. No one's really shown that implicit bias is so important that the whole national conversation about race should have been rerouted toward it. So it just, in terms of, like, this is maybe the most successful idea in my book in terms of how far away it's traveled. There was just a month ago, I think, a Today Show segment that just, it's amazing. In 2021, the Today Show has a segment sort of credulously expressing the power of the IAT. So yeah, there's very little evidence it predicts anything. There's questions about what it's even measuring. It's just sort of crazy how successful it's been despite the lack of evidence.
And you, I mean, in that chapter, you talk about the concepts of reliability and validity. Can you explain how that functions in a kind of psychological setting?
Yeah. So reliability sort of has to do with, like, measurement error within a test, like how accurately it measures what it claims to be measuring. One type of reliability is test-retest reliability. So if I give you a depression test and you take it at noon and it says you're the happiest guy ever, which I know you, Nick, happen to be.
You know, especially at noon.
Especially at noon.
Lunch is, anticipating lunch is like the last good time of the day.
Right. And then you take the same test 2 hours later and it tells you you're at imminent risk of suicide. That would be a very noisy test. The IAT isn't quite that bad, the race IAT, but by any pre-existing psychometric standard, it is way too noisy to be used to diagnose people. We've known this for a while, long before they admitted it. You get very different tests on the IAT in a short period if you retake it. That's one problem. The other problem is validity, which is basically proof that the test is measuring something out in the real world. So the claim for a long time was that you get a high score on the black-white IAT that predicts you're going to discriminate against people. It doesn't seem to, really, except in the tiniest way. I mean, it's statistically significant, but it's almost certainly not relevant to the real world. The best estimate we have is that your IAT score, IAT scores explain about 1% of the variance in people's discriminatory behavior in lab settings, which is just a fancy way of saying that it predicts very little.
Right. And it's, you know, there is more evidence, and this actually is kind of meaningful, that explicit bias is a really good predictor of how people treat one another. So that, you know, people who are overtly racist tend to engage in more racist type behavior, we assume, right?
Well, it's interesting because on a whole host of types of behavior, the connection between our attitudes and our behavior is actually mm-hmm. not as strong okay. as you would expect. So it varies from thing to thing. But the key claim that the IAT folks made is that implicit bias is a better predictor of behavior than explicit bias. I think that's just not warranted. I think it's just false.
Do they suggest, or do people who use kind of versions of this, say like the Robin DiAngelo's of the world, the white fragility, do they offer up ways to fix your implicit bias as well? Or do they kind of just leave it like you are implicitly biased and hence you are a reprehensible human being?
Well, the Robin DiAngelo stuff is much more about trying to, like, instill a sense of guilt, I think. The IAT folks, I think their claim was always, like, hopefully we can rectify it, and they developed
some— But first we have to measure it and kind of acknowledge it.
And they developed, or others especially, developed some potential interventions for doing that. There's some evidence that some of these interventions will lower your score, but there's no evidence any of them will actually change your behavior. So we're more than 20 years into the era of the IAT now, and there's nothing to show for it, basically.
Well, some people's bank accounts have gone up pretty well.
That's for sure.
I just hope that they were in a system where the default setting was switched to investing that money for retirement so that it's— Let me one more particular chapter in the book that I want to talk, and then I want to talk about more general things. This is a chapter called Positive Psychology Goes to War. Can you explain what positive psychology is? Where does that come from? And then how did it come to be a way in which the Pentagon in particular started dealing with veterans who were struggling with various kinds of adjustments after serving in combat?
Yeah, positive psychology was created by or co-founded by a guy named Martin Seligman, who he had developed the concept of learned helplessness early in his career. In these experiments, he would sort of shock dogs to the point where they no longer tried to resist being shocked. It's sort of this idea of an organism giving up because it's been robbed of control over its surroundings. Later in life, he started to believe that psychology focused too much on negative stuff and on pathologies, and his whole argument was, why shouldn't psychologists also try to help basically healthy people get from 75 to 85, which I view as an eminently reasonable thing. I mean, that's why a lot of people meditate or have coaches or whatever. Positive psychology in the eyes of many people.
I was going to say that's why Michael Vick ran dogfighting rings, because it helped him get from 75 to 85.
Exactly.
In his actualization scale.
Yeah, exactly. It's very similar. I'm sure Martin Seligman would appreciate that comparison. So a lot of people thought that positive psychology had sort of a gloss of like used car salesman to it. This includes some people within the field who started worrying in the 21st century, like why we're making these claims that aren't quite backed up by the evidence. So, you know, positive psychologists would say that maintaining a positive attitude could improve your immune system, or that there was this very specific ratio of positive to negative thoughts. And if you could meet that ratio, it could improve your well-being. Many of these claims have been either debunked or are just severely lacking in evidence. So basically, the army in the late aughts linked up with Seligman because there were all these soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were deeply traumatized for understandable reasons. Some of them were committing suicide. A smaller number were committing homicide. Seligman convinced the army that he could take this program he'd already developed at his University of Pennsylvania positive psychology program that was for 10 to 14-year-old school kids to try to prevent anxiety and depression in those kids and adapt it to a military setting. This was always a stretch because when you think about what likely goes into a program designed to make 10 to 14-year-olds feel less stressed out about their homework, and then the leap from that to this 20-year-old is about to go maybe see some friends get blown up, it was never a scientifically justified claim that the one program could work in both settings. There's also not good evidence that the program even works on 10 to 14-year-olds. Despite all this, the Army made it a mandatory program, and it's been that way ever since, and has probably, I'd love a more sort of FOIA competent journalist to piggyback off me on this and get the actual numbers, which we don't have. It's probably cost taxpayers about $500 million. And as I point out in the book, like by Pentagon standards, that's nothing. That's like a few of the fanciest jets. But when you think about what $500 million could do to actually help soldiers with PTSD, it's sort of a crazy scandal in plain sight. And there's never been any evidence this program works or that it should have worked. There's no theory there.
So let's talk about, you also talk about what's called the replicability crisis, in particularly in social psychology. I mean, this is true in many academic fields that run experiments. Can you talk a little bit about replicability and, you know, what is the, how does that intersect with your book in a very prominent way?
Yeah, the replication crisis is basically, I think it's a Greg Easterbrook quote, torture numbers long enough and they will confess to anything. Just the way statistics work, if you throw me enough data or I run enough trials, I can always prove something. It's just not hard to meet what researchers see as the threshold for statistical significance. So around 2010, psychology, particularly social psychology, realized for various reasons that a lot of the research they were publishing was probably crap. And they started aggressively looking back at old studies, particularly famous ones, and trying to replicate them. It turns out that only about half of published experimental psychology studies replicate. And the number is probably lower for social psychology, which to my mind is the epicenter of this sort of half-baked TED Talk phenomenon. So, you know, the connection I think is pretty clear. If researchers are putting out these exciting studies that might not replicate, and then journalists are writing them up, and the TED Talk folks are giving TED Talk investigations, this is a source of a lot of bad ideas that then disseminate throughout society.
Yeah, and that kind of brings us to the prime world phenomenon. You know, Is there a reason to believe that we are more suckers now, you know, en masse for monocausal thinking than in the past? Or is it more that certain things have changed so that you get, you have academics say, and psychologists who want to either make more money or make a name for themselves or are ambitious. They want to improve human life. They come up with a study. Then they find willing people in kind of social media and journalism in, at corporate retreats to give talks where they're remunerated and things like that. What explains, you know, prime world thinking, right now? And is it, do you think it's on the grow because of these larger factors?
Yeah, I think humans, just by dint of our brains, we're always going to be susceptible to less than rigorous monocausal accounts. The argument I make in my book is like this has something to do with America, and particularly America in the last 50 years, like a time of increasing inequality, less and less faith in civic institutions. There's a historian named Daniel Rogers who has a really useful idea. He calls it the age of fracture. Like we feel more and more disconnected, like we're just these free-floating entities rather than that we're firmly rooted in family or civic institutions or churches or whatever else. I think there's a connection there. I think it's not a surprise that like at a time when Americans feel disconnected and don't have faith in political solutions, these ideas rise up where it's like, no, you don't really need politics to solve stuff. You don't need policy. You can really tweak individuals in a way that's, it's not apolitical because a lot of these ideas I would say are like very neoliberal, but you don't have to go through the messy process of like making policy or dealing with political trade-offs. Like these ideas are in a different realm.
And this is, I mean, one of the things that you come back to in several times, which I find both compelling and I probably want to quibble with some of it, but that this type of thinking kind of obviates the need for, you know, true structural adjustments to society. So instead of, you know, suddenly we're not talking about things really like race, class, and gender, to use the kind of holy trinity of critical race theory or of the post-structural, critical theory that is everywhere around us now. Instead, you can work on yourself, whether you're a poor black, you could be a poor black queer, you know, person, and you could make yourself better without having to wait for some kind of social revolution.
I think that's part of it. I also think it's interesting the way these ideas sort of co-opt those conversations. So, you know, in my view, there are obviously certain people have overstated or oversimplified the gender wage gap. It isn't true that men are paid hugely more for exactly the same work. It has more to do with things like child rearing. And, you know, you leave your job at 27, have a kid because you're a woman and you're behind maybe forever. So a lot of these ideas claim to want to help solve these problems in the same way, you know, critical theory does, but then they just slice off a very narrow slice of them. So like power posing was like, well, we just got to make women feel more powerful. It never bothered to prove that that's really what's driving these discrepancies, women not feeling powerful. And I don't think there's much evidence for that. Similarly, the IAT claims to be, you know, a tool to fix racial discrepancies that it claims are caused by implicit bias. That was never really proven. I think these ideas like take these big, complicated, tangled problems and just zoom in on a little bit of them. And if it would be nice if addressing that bit could address the whole thing, but there's often not a lot of evidence that's the case.
One of the things, could you talk a bit about your own past? I mean, this is not a first person book or, you know, a tell all memoir by any stretch, but, you know, certain aspects of your upbringing come into it. And it seems in a lot of ways what it's in no way is it a kind of like Marxist analysis, but you bring in elements of class that a lot of, you know, a lot of the phenomena that are being talked about or the audiences for them, it's all upper class or upper middle class, highly educated people who are kind of looking to make their lives a little bit better, to either feel better about themselves or to gain a little bit of an edge. I mean, I felt a lot of this talking about range restriction. It's kind of like people who know, you know, they're already in the upper, you know, their kids are going to do very well on the SAT, but the difference between, like a 1400 and a 1450 or whatever might really, really matter for them. But where do you come from and how does your kind of sociology, how does it inform the science work that you do?
I mentioned the book a couple times. I come from an upper middle class upbringing outside Boston, and I was sort of a fuck up in high school in like a very boring way. I wasn't doing cool things like drugs or debauchery, but I just like, I didn't try in school. I wasn't motivated. I had no grit, but it didn't really matter because my hometown has a way of basically like picking up kids by the scruff of the neck and dropping them off at the gates of college. You have to screw up really badly to not at least get into college somewhere. And sure enough, I was able to do that. And you know, and then I was able to gain a foothold in journalism because I could do unpaid internships, and to pretend that stuff doesn't matter and that I just had grit or some tremendous amount of talent. I definitely don't have talent, as anyone listening to this can realize. No, I don't want to be falsely modest. I mean, I'm grateful for my success, but that does affect me when you then pretend that we can explain this stuff through just implicit bias or grit. I just don't find those accounts very credible because I know there's a huge number of people as talented as me, if not more so, and much harder working, who haven't been able to get where I've got, and that's solely by dint of where they're born. And that's where I do get a little bit Marxy, even though I'm not a Marxist. I'm Marx curious. Yeah, I don't think that's fair, and I wish we had more social mobility.
It's, well, you know, one of the things that I like about the book, and I think it's hugely important. I mean, you're bringing kind of sociology, and in a broad sense, economics or a different set of reality to science, which is often presented as, purely free of any kind of self-interest, conscious or unconscious. And it seems to me one of the things that is very good, particularly about psychology, ironically, you know, it's a study of the human mind and its actions, but oftentimes people don't recognize that, you know, where they come from changes the way that they see everything. So in that sense, I think it's a great intervention into contemporary debates. Let's talk about Blocked and Reported, which is the podcast, fabulously successful podcast that you are part of with Katie Herzog.
Only because of merit, by the way. We just tried harder than everybody.
It's clear, it's your parents are paying for all of the subscriptions. But what's the goal? What are you hoping to accomplish by Blocked and Reported?
Oh, God. See, what's made it so fun is not having any goals or not really trying to do any one thing in particular. I think Katie and I launched it about a year ago at a time when our corner of media, left of center media, had started to go crazy a little bit. And I think it's only gone crazier since then. There's been a real restriction in what you can discuss. And just by like being two reasonably entertaining people who discuss things that are no longer really getting discussed in a lot of mainstream outlets, we've picked up some steam that way, which we're very grateful for. So I think
what was
real...
the last episode? What did you talk about in the last episode?
Oh, God. Something that I need to stop talking about. We talked about puberty blockers and our stance. I think Katie's a little more skeptical than I am. My stance is like these laws banning them are a really bad idea, a really bad instance of politicians interfering in a legal decision. But there's always that nuance. But we actually don't have good evidence for puberty blockers. And that's the kind of thing where this is a really good example of how dysfunctional media is right now. A week or two ago, NICE, which is sort of the NHS's big organization for systematic reviews of healthcare issues, they did a big review of puberty blockers, and they said the evidence was very weak. So
the evidence was very weak in what way?
The evidence was very weak for the efficacy and safety of puberty blockers, meaning whether and to what extent they help gender dysphoric kids. And no U.S. media outlets picked this up, which is really fucking crazy because that's exactly what we're talking about right now is these laws, which, again, I think are bad. But when it's like only the National Review will pick up the like a paradigmatic example of a mainstream government institution looking into an important question, that, of course, doesn't mean I always trust government institutions. Sure. But this is big news. It should be big news. It's so weird to me, and I just think it's fear. I think it's fear that if you run this story, people will say, "Oh, wow, you want trans kids to be harmed." But no, I want trans kids to have access to good information about whether blockers are good, which isn't proven yet. So that's like the quintessential issue where just by being normal center left, boring Obama types, which Katie and I often are, that's like, there's a niche in the market now for that, which is crazy. There shouldn't be.
You know, why do you think the, as you call it, the kind of center left, or, you know, say like center all the way out to the furthest fringes of the left, why have they become more and more intolerant of, you know, of wide range and kind of freewheeling conversation?
I think it's like a pretty small percentage of vanguard types within these institutions who are able to like really throw their muscle around. When I get in fights with them, I'm at a disadvantage because I don't want them deplatformed. I don't think they're like, I do think some of their views cause harm because I think all views can cause harm if you, but I can't like be like, no, I don't think you should be allowed to say that because it's too harmful. They have like this arsenal of dirty tricks, including sort of calling the manager, as it were. I mean, one of them just tried to get me deplatformed from Substack, where I literally, people pay directly to read my stuff. They're very promiscuous about harm claims. Like if we even hear that there's questions about puberty blockers' efficacy, that leads directly to dead trans kids. This is something you see people genuinely arguing on Twitter against giving people full scientific knowledge of this issue. I don't know, man. I do think it's a small minority. And someone at the New York Times pointed out to me that in the at the peak of the Donald McNeil hysteria, this letter was...
This is the ancient science reporter who had his account of, or he went on a class trip that was sanctioned by the New York Times with a bunch of high school students a few years ago, used the N-word, was cleared of an internal investigation, and then a new investigation basically ended with him resigning or being fired.
Yeah, pushed out. He was definitely pushed out. 150 New York Times staffers, not all of them editorial, some of them on the tech side and stuff, signed a really crazy letter, basically demanding his reinvestigation. As someone within the Times pointed out to me, that's like a tenth of the newsroom. That does not reflect mainstream newsroom opinion.
But they're the ones, as you pointed out, they're the ones calling the shots, right?
That's what's crazy about it, is Dean Baquet subsequently told him, you've lost the newsroom. Which is such a crazy thing to say for a couple of reasons, one of which is, who the fuck cares if the newsroom, whatever that means, doesn't like one particular science reporter? Imagine if we like, if we actually held that standard. I can't write for any outlet where people won't like what I say. Who gets to decide? Second of all, it's not the newsroom. It's a ninth or a tenth of the newsroom, but just the ninth or the tenth that will spend all day internally policing their opponents within their own organization.
So where is this vanguard coming from? Is it, you know, and I mean, is it people who are seeking, you know, racial and sexual orientation equality or something? I know Katie Herzog, your co-host on Blocked and Reported, you know, talks about how she's a lesbian. And that's like, that's part of the problem now. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, being lesbian was kind of an identity that made you kind of, you know, people skeptical of you in certain circumstances, including, you know, I mean, you know, large parts of the Democratic Party. And now that's seen as helplessly retrograde. Who, you know, what are the characteristics of the people who are that 10% or that 10% who are really clamping down on everyone?
I don't know. I mean, there's been this real, I do think a lot of this comes down to the harm claims. I mean, I just did a article for you guys for a reason about this crazy college story where because a woman briefly interrupted a white fragility training and said she disagreed with its tenets, she was investigated for 9 months and her administration said she harmed hundreds of her colleagues just for being exposed to this milquetoast centrist opinion. I don't know. I think it's just as much about power as about actual ideology. I think people like to, especially given that journalism's collapsing, they like to be able to exert some control and make sure their friends benefit and their enemies are punished.
Something similar in academia is like that too, where the number of tenure track positions as a overall percentage are declining. I mean, there's a major kind of business model shift in academia as well as journalism going on.
I think that explains it as much as anything. Mm-hmm. There's stuff going on. George Floyd was killed in horrific fashion. People do want to address that. But oftentimes the fights within newsrooms, Donald McNeil is a great example because, you know, whatever slightly conservative old white guy views he had, this is a guy who dedicated much of his career to like jetting around the world to sit with dying AIDS and cancer patients and tell their stories. a lot of these blowups don't really have anything to do with social justice. The idea that because he mentioned the N-word once, that hurts anyone, or at least that we should weigh that as heavily as his decade. I mean, it's a lot of this stuff is really laughable.
Do you think some of it is generational? I mean, this is also a way, the baby boom, which I am, you know, I am the cloaca of the baby boom towards the very
good
end.
Word.
But they are clogging up everything. They're not going anywhere. We have like an 80-year-old president, right? A pre-baby boom president. As old people refuse to kind of exit the stage, do they need to be forced out? And especially we're running out of icebergs, right, because of global warming. Like, where are we going to put all the old people when we kick them out?
We need, like, detention centers where they can play, like, soothing John Denver music or whatever. Maybe that's not the right reference. I think it's partly generational. I also think a lot of polling suggests that the Vanguard position is not even popular among millennials or Zoomers. The loudest, most easily angered people, you know, it's a human version of the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And it's a... I think in some of these outlets, if the people who are worried about what's going on could really unify and just like make it clear that they disagree, maybe that could do some good. I find instead, for understandable reasons, they feel isolated. They reach out to people like me or Katie or maybe some of our mutuals to talk about this stuff. So it's a good time to only have one foot rather than two in mainstream journalism. I'm happy with where I'm at.
Yeah. Do you think it is also, and I mean, you've worked at places like New York Magazine, which is, you know, it counts as legacy media really in the current climate. Is there a connection between the fact, and this is some defenders of cancel culture will say, you know what, it's not cancel culture. It's just that people who never had a voice before for a wide variety of reasons now have a voice and they're engaging in conversations. And you, Jesse Singel, and maybe you, Nick Gillespie, or Reason or whatever, you don't like it because you're hearing from new perspectives that are telling you to go fuck yourself. And, you know, and I guess I ask this, you are on Blocked and Reported, you guys talk about how you're both doing better than ever kind of financially through, you know, Patreon, Substack, a new media landscape, which allows you to go directly to audiences without having to go through, you know, being hired by somebody and then being edited and then being put out by some kind of corporate platform or something like that. What is the connection, do you think, between, you know, the vitriol that we see going on and the fact that more people can speak from, you know, in more ways than ever before?
Some of it is resentment. I mean, Ben Smith just had an article about the sort of the Substack wars that people should read. There was a contrived effort to like pretend Substack was doing something immoral or unfair or misleading.
Right. By offering offering payments advances to certain people. Yeah, like a basically.
Yeah, I was not one of them, but you know, Glenn Greenwald, Matt Taibbi, Matt Iglesias. Well, I guess the line that really what we're mad about is like marginalized people finally having a voice is so ridiculous, and for several reasons. One of which is, you know, we're like, when did the new Jim Crow come out? Michelle Alexander's book. When did Ta-Nehisi Coates really? The current incarnation of race talk is not really new, or like you know, the attention paid to racial injustice. It's been going on for a long time, and when the new Jim Crow came out, none of us were like, oh no, that's horrible, because it didn't. Whatever you think of the book, it didn't reflect this very identitarian, illiberal understanding of argument and evidence and debate. Something genuinely new is going on. I think it could be spurred by social media. And I think in the long run, a lot of these outlets are just going to have to decide how much money and how many eyeballs they're willing to leave on the table to mollify the Vanguard. I mean, I will always have a soft spot for New York Magazine. They changed my life by hiring me. I don't think New York Magazine in the long run can maintain a state of health if someone like Andrew Sullivan is too far to the right to be associated with it. And they still have like John Chait, who's a good sort of heterodox liberal, but it should tell people something that Katie and I can just sort of like set up this crappy little podcast and immediately gain an audience. And it should tell people something more, that people like Joe Rogan are wildly successful, yep, or Sam Harris. And these are not, I know they, people try to present them as like evil right-wing figures, and they have, you know, they're somewhere in the middle, but it's so weird that this stuff goes ignored, and that Yeah, it's just not healthy what's going on right now, but we have a harbor.
It seems as if, you know, an outfit like the New York Times, and this is, you know, kind of Marxist or economic analysis. I mean, it is a subscriber-based service now. It gets the vast majority of its revenue from subscribers. And so it may find that it serves them better by becoming more and more woke as opposed to trying to appeal to some kind of journalistic objectivity or a standard where you know, they are trying to adjudicate all kinds of competing reality claims. Instead, they want to play to the bias of their viewers, just like Fox News or MSNBC.
Yeah. You know, and for the Times, it might. Well, there's a good New York Magazine article by Reeves Weedman on this very question. The Times. Times is different because it has such a huge audience. And the average piece of content published by the Times has nothing to do with wokeness. It's just journalism and often excellent journalism. Outlets, if you're like... what's a good example? You know, Vox or Slate. That's where I'm really curious if they're going to be able to maintain an audience in the long run, setting aside all the structural dumpster fire. A lot of the opinions these outlets are publishing reflect like 5% of American public opinion. I mean, the puberty blocker thing's a great example, where it's just like a genuine debate. You would not know it's a debate from reading left of center outlets. But, you know, we'll talk about it on Blocked or Imported and we'll take the money instead.
Do you think, you know, you mentioned in a broad context, you've published at Reason. I don't think that you would consider yourself certainly not a doctrinaire libertarian by any stretch. There's a lot of overlap, though, in that, you know, the core liberal value, whether you're talking about it in a classical sense or in a contemporary sense, of free speech and free expression is like really central, not only as a civil liberty, but as part of the process through which, you know, people actually openly talking, discussing, debating. That's how we get better knowledge of the various ways that we might choose to live, either individually or in groups. Is that among millennials and Gen Z, the people that you you know, is that ideal really gone? And if it is, what are the ways to kind of argue for its you know, resurgence?
I don't think it's gone. I mean, again, we the most wildly successful media figures often engage in that. And that's even, you know, people who are like woke. Like one of the most successful trans creators is ContraPoints, a trans woman who got famous doing videos that actually engaged with alt-right positions to explain why she thought they were ridiculous. There's obviously a market for that. There's obviously a market for what me and Katie are doing. And it's not like all our listeners are 70 and up. I mean, I think people love debate and discussion. And there's this very small group of people who have been very successful at pathologizing it and treating it as ridiculous. The idea that you can never improve the state of the world through discussion or find truth that way. I think my favorite example is when they'll just sort of confidently spout this. It's like a piety at this point that we needed the Civil War to end slavery. Like discussion couldn't have ended slavery. It's like, well, first of all, discussion did get Abraham Lincoln elected, which was a pretty big part of that process. Second of all, in a lot of countries, they did end slavery without a drop of blood being spilled. So the world is complicated. I'm not saying that open debate of everything will always lead to the best or truest idea or that there can't be backsliding, but to just give up belief in the possibility of people talking out their disagreement is ridiculous, especially if you're a journalist or an academic, because that should be why you're in the game in the first place.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you, Jesse Singel. He's the author of the new book, The Quick Fix, Why Fad Psychology Can't Cure Our Social Ills. Jesse, thanks for talking.
Nick, thank you so much for having me.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.